Yeah, this is Michael Dean. We're rolling. Go ahead.
This is Paul Gordon Collier with the Disassociation Nation, and I am conducting an interview with Michael W. Dean. Do you like being Michael W. Dean, or just Michael Dean, or just Dean, or just...
Anything but Frank. Mike. You know, Mike's not my name. Frank? I don't know. Frank's not me.
Frank's not me,
and Mike's not me. People always assume, you know, when your name's Michael, like, oh, hey, Mike. And I'm like,
what's up?
It's not my name, man.
But you're not saying hi to the Mike, what's up?
Yeah.
So Michael Dean is the co-founder of Freedom Fiends, and Freedom Fiends is my morning breakfast. I'm usually not up at 1 a.m., so I don't get to hear your show live. But I do have the Freedom Fiends app, and you can go to the Google Play. And is it Google Play? It's available on Google Play Store.
Yeah, it's free.
Amazon.
Yeah, it's free on both. And you can just go to the Freedom Fiends site, and at the top right, there's a little link that'll click. You can go right to the Google Play Store. It's easier to get on Google Play than Amazon. Amazon, for some reason, makes it not terribly easy to download and install apps because they want to get you to download their app downloader or something. Whereas, you know, Google made Android, and you know, it's a Google system, so their store is really integrated with, you know, one button install kind of stuff.
And I did just close my windows so we don't hear any more Facebook sounds in the background.
All right, I just closed mine too.
And you are also the former lead singer of The Bomb. And it's called The Bomb, not Bomb, but The Bomb, right?
No, you're wrong. It's called Bomb.
It's called Bomb, man. Yeah. I got it wrong.
Yeah, Bomb started in 1986, and we broke up in 1993. There's a band called The Bomb, which is guys from the band Naked Ray Gun. And I always thought it was kind of stupid that they called their band The Bomb, because they, it's kind of confusing with our band. And our band had broken up. And I don't believe in intellectual property, but James Babb put it really well. I think it was James Babb on the Freedom Fiends that...
he's been on our show, too.
Yeah, and so I've heard a bunch of fiends on your show. And he said that if you're in a creative field, don't be not creative. You know, if you're in a creative field, don't steal someone else's thing, basically. And... They definitely knew we existed because Bomb had opened up for Naked Ray Gun at one point. So, yeah, let me see what year they started. They started in...
I think you can also argue that... I mean, I'm with you on the IP stuff, but it's almost... I mean, maybe some social shaming is in order, but it's just not cool to represent yourself as something that maybe you're not, because other people will think of your band, and that's not them.
Well, I guarantee that every time that band plays, and they started in 99, 6 years after we broke up, so they probably figured, well, you know, that name's not being used anymore. But, you know, I kind of think you retire the number. You know, if the athlete kicks ass and my band kicked ass and had a following, you know, you kind of retire the number. And we called the band Bomb before, you know, hey, that's The Bomb was a saying.
To be clear, I mean, Bomb, The Bomb, I could see other people spontaneously coming up with that name.
And there's a hip hop.
You're talking about when you know.
Right. Like, we had literally opened for Naked Ray Gun, you know, and the singer in the band was like, shook my hand and said, hey, I really like your band afterwards. So they knew we existed. I guarantee that every time they play, and I've heard this from people, like one or two people think it's my band reunited, pay to get in, and then, you know, go up to them and say, hey, I thought you were this other band, you know? So, like, it's kind of fraud, but it's kind of, and as far as IP, like, I don't believe in copyright or patent, but I kind of believe in trademark, not backed by government guns, but I kind of feel like your name is the only thing you have. And, you know, that's what you build.
And I was actually talking with Niz, our co-host, who isn't here right now. And the reason he's not here is because he's fighting off a drone attack. But that's to be expected.
Yeah.
He he has a vaping company, and he's thinking about, you know, if I put the BIPCOT no gov. Oh, I forgot to mention that, by the way. This interview is covered by a BIPCOT no gov license. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's,
yeah, I've heard of it. It's we're thinking of using it for my show too. No, actually, I'm joking. I came up with it.
I know.
It's,
I know.
I'm saying, people can't see us winking. So I'm
all right.
And there are going to be other people listening besides you. So I'm watching squirrels have sex. Literally,
I just plan on my this mom is so listening
cool.
to this.
I'm That's watching it. Squirrels have sex in the yard. This is cool. It's springtime, man. It must be.
I hope it's state approved. Is it?
Well, I don't know. You know how the EPA is. They can take over your farm because you have a mud puddle. I'm sure that they can do so. DJ, that's look out true. The window. The squirrels are doing that's, it on the back of the tree.
Yeah, that's true, dude. Dude, you're going to have to shut down your house because this is a breeding ground for the rare squirrel.
Oh, yeah. Squirrels are rare. You know, squirrels are one of the...
only a million left.
There's a billion, right. trillion, zillion. Squirrels are... you know, the people always, the libertarian answer to what would you do about, you know, endangered animals is always eat them. You know, if you don't want buffalo to go away, eat buffalo burgers and people will breed them. You know, like chickens are never going to go away. Beef cows are never going to go away. But then there's all these other animals that there's like five or six animals that are in every town, in every state in America I've ever been to. And squirrels are one of them that people don't generally eat. Humans, squirrels, deer, turkeys, and rabbits.
We do eat deer and turkey.
But we don't breed them. People don't breed, and I don't have a mouse in my pocket, and mice and rats. But a lot of these things probably exist like they do because of proximity to humans. I think, you know, the reason there's mice and rats in such quantity is because of grain production and just, you know, people having garbage cans ones. Yeah, and raccoons
we basically give them a progressive drink.
Yeah,
they just get their food handed to them from others. So yeah. I mean, they're living the progressive dream. So squirrels are
they're edible. Done by the way. I mean, this took like
edible
they
I mean, have eaten squirrels, by the way.
They don't have sex for very long is what I'm saying. Like they're well done now. I mean, they're all, you ever see this dance they do where they jump up in the air when they're frisky? It's their mating
only
dance.
Only on video.
I'm
only
watching on it.
Video. Really? Oh, they're doing it now? There's like the after party. This is the sex after party, the squirrel sex after party.
I think it's the before party for the next mating coupling. There's three squirrels out there. Put it that way.
So this is not state approved.
No, I don't know if they're gay marrying out there, but they're definitely promiscuous.
By the way, if you do see state non-approved sex happening with your squirrels, remember, you don't have to call the police. You can call, 411?
Cell 411. Yeah, it's getcell411.com.
You can call get one of your friends to help you before you call the police.
Yeah.
If squirrels are having non-state approved sex.
And I do recommend cell 411 at getcell411.com. It's not going to be quite as world-changing as Bitcoin, but it's going to be close. And I'm not kidding about that. It's this free app for Android and iOS that this guy Virgil has come up with that's kicking butt. I mean, it's had like 20,000 downloads in a week, which is, you know, what the Fiends app has had like, you know, 100 downloads in 2 weeks or something.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, I know. Hey, DJ, look at the squirrels. They're doing it. Oh, you're in the bathroom? Okay.
This nature documentary.
I know.
Brought to you by Michael Dean, who also brought you Guns and Weeds.
Guns and Weeds?
Guns and Weeds.
Yeah, weeds.
Guns and Weeds. You put your weeds in it.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a very, very important, relevant question.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with Bomb?
The band Bomb?
Yeah, the band Bomb. Band Bomb.
Well, I co-started it. I co-start most things I'm involved with. There's only one thing that I can think of that somebody else already had and I joined. Actually, two things. There's two bands that I played guitar in that like already, you know, had their set written, were doing shows, had an audience, and their guitar player, in one case, got kicked out of the boarding school he was going to. This was when I was 21 and the guys in the band were like 17. I played in a band called the Beef People in Virginia.
Well, there's a
Yeah, that's a good name. Named after the Winn-Dixie motto. And he got kicked out of the boys' school he went to for having a girl in his room. And I lived like 40 miles away. I used to drive 40 miles each way to practice with them. And I, you know, learned all their songs, wrote a couple songs with them, recorded a 7-inch EP, played about 5 shows, and then they graduated and we broke up. And that was like, that was punk rock cred back in the day. Like, you didn't do, you know, like you didn't start another band. Back in the day, if anybody quit your band or you lost one member, even if it was the drummer, you changed the band name, replaced him, and started a whole new set.
Purity.
Yeah, but they couldn't do that at that school because there wasn't another guitar player there. So we broke that rule, but then we had the punk rock rule of, you know, when they graduate and you go your separate ways, you break the band up and you only put out one, you know, 7-inch record and you play like 8 shows. And that's punk rock cred, man. And we also recorded that at Inner Ear Studio, which was the most punk rock cred studio back in the 80s. So that band and then this band called Insecto that I played with and never recorded with in D.C. It was my roommate's band, and their guitar player quit like on a Wednesday, and they had a show on a Friday. And he's like, hey, can you learn our set in 2 days? And I'm like, of course. It's simple music. And I learned it and practiced with them twice and played one show with them, and then he said, hey, can you play with us? We got a couple more shows next month. Can you play with us until we get a guitar player? And I said, yeah, and I ended up playing for 9 months with them, playing like 20 shows. And it was great. Like, I didn't even own equipment at the time. I would just like show up. I didn't even sound check with them or practice with them. I would just show up at the gig, play, grab a girl, and then leave. You know, I didn't get paid. They didn't make any money, but it was fun.
It wasn't one of their girls, right? I mean,
no. You know, okay. It was L.A. People share,
right?
Yeah, but Bomb, I co-founded.
So then we get to the Bomb.
Well, Bomb was before all that. Bomb was 86 to 93. Well, actually, the Beef People were before that. That was Beef People were like 83 to 84, and then Insecto was like, you know, 98 or something. But I'm trying to think of how Bomb started. I know that I played with Jay, the guitar player, before we met the drummer. I'm trying to think, like, how I even met. Oh, I know how I met him. I was at a show of this band called Victim's Family, who were kind of a well-known punk rock band back in the day. They were from El Paso, Texas, and then they moved to San Francisco and did some records on Jello Biafra's label, Alternative Tentacles. And I was at a show of Victim's Family, and no, it was the Rhythm Pigs, another band from Texas that moved to San Francisco.
Of course it was the Rhythm Pigs. How could you mistake
them? Well, actually it's easy to mistake because they were both three-piece hardcore punk rock bands with a really heavy jazz influence, kind of like the Minutemen, who did like stop on a dime music that went that like changed time signature in the middle of a song. So I was at this show at the Kennel Club in San Francisco, and I had just moved there from San Francisco, from Virginia, and I'd been in this band called Baby Opaque, which were kind of a stop on a dime, change time signatures in the middle of a song band. And I had some of my records. Like, we'd put out a couple records, and one of them was sold out. We pressed 1,000 of each one. One was sold out, and the other I had like 20 left when I moved to San Francisco, and I took them with me. I was sleeping on my friend's floor at the time, and I was like, well, I've got these records, you know, I'll take them to this bar and try to sell them for beer money. And I was walking around the bar trying to sell records for a band no one had heard of. And I went up to this guy, Jay Crawford, I tried to sell one to his wife. He was like out smoking pot or something. And a few minutes later, this guy came up to me with the woman and said, hey, I hear you're trying to sell your record. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, I'm looking for people to play with, and I really like your initiative. I really like that you're walking around a bar trying to sell a record people never heard of. That's the kind of guy I want to be in a band with. Are you any good?
What was your sales pitch?
Hey, this is my band. I just moved here from Virginia. We're great. These usually sell for $10. I'll sell you one for $5 or a couple beers. And
now, you didn't add in, they usually sell for $10, but nobody buys them. But that's the price that we have.
Well, actually, the way it worked in punk rock was like, you know, you'd press 1,000 of them. They'd cost like $2 each to press. and then you'd sell enough of them to make back the money you spent, and then the rest of them you usually trade with other bands for their record or trade for beer. So people did buy them.
Or other.
Yeah, like, you know, we put out enough. So I gave him one, and he bought me a beer, and he said, what's your phone number? If this is good, I'll call you, and we'll jam. And I wrote my friend's phone number where I was sleeping on his couch, where I was actually, I jammed with two other people that month. One was East Bay Ray from Dead Kennedys, and I went and tried out for his post-Dead Kennedys band, which never went anywhere, and I didn't pass the audition. And then I didn't get the gig, but I was also jamming with more than once and having a really good time jamming with Dave Immergluck, who is now in Counting Crows and is a big rock star. And he really liked me. I really liked him.
Does he still call you?
No, he doesn't still call me, but he played in my band Slish too later. But yeah, he's the guy that taught me to say worms. He's the reason all the Fiend fans say worms. Yeah, he was saying it as a joke in like 1985, you know, like, and it was already like the hip hop slang of saying word, which means yes, affirmative, I agree with you, you speak the word, you speak the truth. That was already like really dated hip hop slang by like 85. I mean, it was
I thought it meant World Order Reliance Machine.
Oh, Davy Barker came up with a whole bunch of acronyms for it. That's one I haven't heard. I like that one. But yeah, man, Dave Immergluck. If anybody ever sees Counting Crows and gets backstage who's listening to this, go up to talk to Dave Immergluck. He's the really tall guy that plays guitar in the band with the big hair. Tell him Michael Dean says hi, and tell him that there's thousands of people or hundreds and dozens of people saying the word worms now because of him.
There's got to be at least hundreds.
He'll think that's funny. Okay. Yeah.
I say it in my house now.
Yeah.
Nobody gets it.
You have kids?
My daughter, she's 11. She's starting to pick it up.
I would think that'd be perfect for an 11-year-old. It's kind of that mentality.
Oh, yeah. Work on the next generation.
Yeah.
See, that's what you got to do. You got to work on the next generation. You got to spread the worms around is what you got to do.
Spread the worms.
I mean, really, actually, that should be a Freedom Fiends button, spread the worms.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I don't know why it hasn't happened already.
I think the next one is actually going to be Ask Me About My Fungus, I think.
Oh, my fungus.
I think you missed some shows if you're not laughing at that.
I missed some shows. I have missed some shows.
Yeah, I talked openly about my butt fungus.
Oh, yes. Okay. I've heard these conversations, and I was actually at some point.
You blocked it
maybe
out.
Maybe or maybe not. I might have just went into like a word coma. That's my dog, by the way. I do not have a studio to block the boy out. His name is Maximo. He is pit bull, cane corso mix.
Nice.
And he's a boss. He's a total boss. Hey, buddy. Are you supposed to do peaceful parenting with your dog, by the way?
You don't hit him, but you can probably yell at him. I don't know. I don't have dogs. I had cats. And if you yell at a cat, they just hide under their bed and don't learn anything. So I
do hit my dog. I don't hit him to hurt him, but I do hit him to know. Like, let's see, the other day, my wife accident. She didn't even know that he was by her side, and she threw her hand down, looked like a fist, and it almost hit him. And he nipped at her. He didn't bite her, but he just kind of nipped at her. And so I gave him a jab in the ribs, not to hurt him, just to let him know, dude, no, that crossed the line. And then I dragged him into the bathroom and I left him in there for 10 minutes. Now, I would not do that with my daughter. I'm just going to tell you, I would not do that with my daughter.
I've never had a dog, so I don't know anything about them. I know that they're a lot different than cats. Hey, hang on a sec. Let me take a 2-minute break. I'll be right back. I want to save this file and pee-pee kitty. Okay, go ahead.
And we're back with Michael Dean on Disassociation Nation.
And, you know, we didn't fully explain the BIPCOP no-gov license. It means that anybody could use this interview any way, shape, or form, any way that they would like, unless, of course, they're with the government. Now, I add this bit, and it's good that I have you on the show because you can tell me what you think. I usually add this bit. Even if you are just going to use it to advocate for the government, can't touch it. Is that a bridge too far?
If I'm understanding you correctly, no, it absolutely. You mean, could somebody use something that's BIPCOT covered to make fun of it while advocating for the government? To advocate for the government?
I don't care whether they make fun of it, but if they're going to use it to advocate for the government.
No, of course not. Hey, now there's a rabbit in my backyard. I don't know how rabbits get in my backyard because we have a a wooden fence that goes all the way around, and there's like they must have dug a hole, man. Yeah, yeah,
they dig underground. They're burrowers, man.
Yeah,
they're burrowers.
It's weird though. I don't see where the hole is, but yeah, I like.
So you got with Bomb.
Yeah,
you got with Bomb in a roundabout way by selling records for a band that nobody ever heard of.
I want to come back to Bipcot though, but go ahead.
Okay. No. Well, let's.
No, I want to talk about Bomb, man. Nobody ever asked about Bomb. Everyone asked about Bipcot. So go ahead, Bipcot. So go ahead. Ask about Bomb.
Wow, that was a Freudian slip there. Yeah. That was nice.
Bip cop.
Okay, so I thought you said something else.
Cock.
Maybe
yeah.
That was a Freudian slip.
Bip rooster. Oh, go on.
Okay. Well, it ended with CK. I'll just say that. So, when you got with Bomb, what were your, I'm going to say, your musical and or artistic influences?
Oh, I thought you were going to say goals. Because my goals.
Oh, gosh.
My You're goals were. My goals were to play good music, play some gigs, get laid, you know, get paid $20, and maybe play some gigs out of town. And we ended up like touring America 6 times and touring Europe once and making 4 records and getting signed to Warner Brothers, which was way beyond what my goals were. I didn't think it was possible when we started, because in 1986. There were no weird bands that were signed. Like, it was hair metal time. And we got signed in 1990, right after Nirvana got signed and Jane's Addiction got signed. Like, those two kind of broke down the doors for, like, you know, every...
So, Juanos Addicciones.
Yeah, that band. That lady's Spanish is bad. At the beginning of that, but
I know it's cool though.
Yeah, it's cool. It's weird. It's funny.
See, but, it's funny. It's like that says Nirvana.
I just saw the bunny. I see where he gets in now. Okay, he's dug a little bit under the gate. That's how he's getting in and
this
out.
This nature show brought to you by Michael W.
The thing is though, there's no plants in my backyard. Like, I think he just comes in here to like get away from dogs or something, because there's nothing to eat in the backyard.
Huh. Maybe there's a lady bunny in there.
A lady bunny.
State-approved bunny sex.
My backyard is a bunny rape room. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's run by Saddam Hussein. Yeah. I don't know if you knew that, but...
Yes, he's not really dead. And he's hiding in the tree in my backyard where the squirrels live. All right, so, there's a tree in my backyard that's like... I'm looking at it right now. It's like 25 feet from where I'm sitting that got struck by lightning on my 50th birthday... While my wife and I were in this room watching a movie. I mean, it sounded like it was louder than a shotgun would be going off in the same room with you. It was unbelievably loud.
Did you suffer any hearing loss? Because
no. Well,
did that with a shotgun.
Maybe it wasn't louder than a shotgun would be next to your head, but it was as loud as a shotgun would be outside, you know, 8 feet away from you. So it was very, very loud, but it was bassier than a shotgun. Like, a shotgun doesn't shake the house. Like, this rattled the windows. And it took a strip of bark like 25 feet long, 5 inches wide, and 3 inches deep. Like, it, you know, this tree still looks like a giant just scratched it with his fingernail. But it was weird because it was my 50th birthday, and I was like, man, I never thought I'd live to be this long.
There's no message there.
I know, but I caused it by accident. I made lightning.
A metal rod in your tree?
No, sort of. We had roots in the toilet tube. You know, the tube that goes out of the house and connects with the city toilet water.
Line?
Yeah, the sewage line. That thing. We have one of those old ones that's like made of paper and wax. You know, it's called yellow cake, something like that. But yellow cake. But, like, literally it needs to be replaced, but it would be, like, $6,000.
That's why we bombed Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, because of my sewage line. So Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, says, basically, like, instead of paying $6,000 to dig it up and replace it, I don't have that. So I just pay Roto-Rooter $120 to come once a year and root it out, because it gets the tree roots get into it. So Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, says, oh, you don't need to do that. Just pour copper sulfate down there. Get $10 worth of it on Amazon. Yes. You know, get 5 pounds of copper sulfate and pour a cup down your toilet every week. So I'm doing that for like 4 weeks, and then lightning strikes this tree. I think what happened, like, copper sulfate is highly conductive. I think it just got into the roots of the tree probably killed the roots that were in you know, at the time in the sewer line. But before it killed them, all this copper sulfate got sucked up into the tree and turned it into a, you know, 70-foot lightning rod. Into a
lightning rod.
Yep.
That's actually kind of cool to think about.
That. Yeah.
Is the tree still living?
It is. Well, we'll see soon. I mean, it's spring, and the trees haven't started budding yet, but they will in 2 or 3 weeks. So if it doesn't bud, it's dead, and I'm going to have to get a tree surgeon to remove it, which is going to be a lot of money. But because it's huge. It's a big old cottonwood that, you know, I mean, this is like, you know, this tree probably weighs 10 tons.
So getting back to the bomb, if I say the bomb one more time, you get to shock me.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Do you have the Fiendphone shock collar on?
I do not.
All my co-hosts have the shock collar. Yeah. Okay.
I ordered it. I didn't get it in the mail yet.
Good. So, so what do you want to know?
So you gave me your goals, but I'm interested in
influences.
Not just musical, but if there were. I have a suspicion about something. I want to see if I'm right.
Well, I used to joke, like half joke, half seriously, that you know, people say, "What's your band sound like?" And I'd say, "We sound like a cross between Beatles, Bauhaus, Black Flag, and the Bay City Rollers," which literally is kind of true. Like the first three were all influences on us. Bay City Rollers were not an influence on us, but we were way more melodic and musical and pop influenced than a lot of punk bands, but we played the punk circuit.
What did you think of the Cocteau Twins?
I like them, but I don't think they were an influence. But I mean, some of the stuff from that era, you know, the early 80s synth pop.
They're highly melodic.
No, you know who was an influence on us was Depeche Mode. And we even covered and recorded the song. We covered the song Personal Jesus like 10 years before Marilyn Manson did. Yeah, there's a recording of it.
Is that on video? Do you have that up on YouTube?
No, there's not much video of us. There is. I can send you the audio of it. But
you have the audio. Like, I listened to a few of yours.
Oh,
you know, it's just a picture of you.
Yeah. I didn't put those up. Somebody else put those up. I'll bet that it. Let me check while we're talking. But yeah, we recorded it in Germany. Personal Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the song well. I went through a Depeche Mode phase. I would get all of their albums when, you know, I went through the whole.
Yeah, here it is.
British alternative phase.
Yeah. Yeah, that's me singing and playing bass. Yeah. I'll send you that. You can I like that. Link
that's awesome.
Yeah, and Marilyn Manson's version of it is a cover of our version of it. If you listen to his version from 10 years later, it definitely has, he's definitely heard our version of it because his sounds more like our version than it sounds like the Depeche Mode version.
So when I listen to the Freedom Fiends, even there's just a general vibe that I get from you. And, you know, the Freedom Fiends really reflects a lot your character, I think.
Even when I'm not on it.
Even when you're not on it. Because I think you've assembled people.
I've trained them.
Or either that or you've just picked the right.
I've picked the right ones, but they've also picked it up for me. And, you know, it's also like, there's some consistency. Like, it's the same music all the time. All the music on the Freedom Fiends is my music. And, you know, they all do the intro.
When you say your music, do you mean it's all... I thought it was all Bomb, but it's not all Bomb?
No, some of it's Bomb. Some of it... the opening song, the really toe-tappy one, is Bomb. Some of the music is myself and Nima Vidati, the guy that started the show with me.
Yep.
And some of it,
I'm going to have him on our show eventually.
So he's good. He's good. And some of it is, my one man punk band, Right Arm of Wyoming. And some of it,
one man punk band. I like that. That's so punk.
Yeah, actually. It is. And some of it is, like the song at the end, the really upbeat one, which I actually call Stinson Sunrise. Stinson is a surf town in, right. California. But it's,
yeah, I know. I reckon when I hear the music, I'm like, oh, it's over.
But I wrote that for
it's
the show.
It's sad music to me now.
I wrote it. Yeah, it's upbeat music that says, until tomorrow. Yeah.
It means go. Yeah. Away. You don't have to leave, but y'all need to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I listen to you guys, My overall vibe for the Freedom Fiends, especially from you, is there is a... I sense Dadaism so much in what you do. And
yeah, Dada's an influence on me for sure.
And I understand that Dadaists, they were... I don't know.
They were lefty.
They were lefty anarchists.
Yeah, which I'm not. But
right. But there's a. I mean, for me, now back in the day, I was actually in the lefty circle, so I wouldn't have really cared that much. But I always loved the Dadaists. What I love about the Dadaists was they had more energy and more. They were more active than a lot of the other movements. They got in your face, and I really liked that.
Yeah. I mean, that was over before we were born, of course, but...
The Dadaist movement, it still has ripples throughout, but it was, you know, during... It was a response to World War One.
Yeah.
And it's kind of ironic that the Dadaists... I'll give them a pass, but if I really want to be critical, the Dadaists were pretty much anti-establishment.
They were anti-war, too, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think they were.
As a matter of fact, they were absolutely a direct response to what they saw. Now, they were thinking somehow that owning property was a part of this. They didn't quite make the full leap and realize it was not property that was the problem. It's the state that was the problem. And by the way, I want to recommend, if you have Netflix, look for a documentary called either The Great War Diaries, or I think if you can find it, if you look for 14 Diaries of the Great War. It is the best war documentary you will ever see, and it really shows how the war really it laid bare the nature of the state, how the state looks at you as a process, as a tool. So long as it's convenient for the state to give you some freedoms and some roads and some liberties and a little space to have an iPod, great. But when it's no longer good for the state to give you those things or allow you to have those things, it will truly grind you down into puppy sauce.
Yeah, there's puppy sauce. There's a case I saw the other day, and this happens every once in a while. There was some constitution licking, we got to get back to the republic kind of, one of these people that hates the government but waves the flag of the government.
My
flag! Yeah, right. A guy who has total, what's that syndrome? Stockholm syndrome. I forget his name, but it was some guy in Montana who had some really horrible talk show or blog talk radio podcast.
Yeah. I saw that you made it clear because they were saying that he got arrested for hate speech or
for weapons. Really yeah, weapons. And I changed it to shitty audio, crappy audio.
You can't have bad audio.
It's, yeah. It's terrible. Yeah. It should be a crime. So it's a hate crime. But, the headline that the SPLC, who really I consider a part of the government at this point, because they do advise the government on who's a terrorist and who's not, and they get it way wrong. And when they started, they were right on. When they were started, all they did was like, you know, tracked violent, you know, KKK types. And now, like, if you say you like the Constitution.
Back in the late 80s, early 90s, Morris Deese, he's the guy that I believe that he started it. Or
yeah, he did.
He used to be my hero. I loved what he was doing.
Henry Rollins from Black Flag donates a lot of money to the SPLC, I think, still.
They went so much further.
That's the problem with the punk rockers, too, man. Like, Dead Kennedys taught me, listening to their records, you know, in the early 80s, even late 70s, like 79, 80, 81, taught me to distrust the government. But, like, that guy wants government. He wants the Green Party to, like, you know, basically.
Right.
He's probably stumping for Bernie. I don't know. He thinks Obama doesn't go far enough.
Well, because, you know, the government got it wrong all these years. But if we just give them more control.
They don't get it. It's so weird, man. Because, like, Dead Kennedys and MDC, this band, Millions of Dead Cops, that used to be my upstairs neighbors in San Francisco. Those bands, like, they so got it right on what was wrong with Reagan. Like, they had the most scathing, smart lyrics about, like, what was wrong with Reagan, what was wrong with the global situation at the time. I just always assumed that they'd feel the same way about the left, but they don't, you know? That's the problem with punk rock.
Well what I see from, not necessarily punk rock, but the folks from the left, You know, I find myself, since I crossed over, I've been crossed over for about a year now. That's what I term it, crossed over. And since I crossed over, I find myself sounding more and more like the left when I describe American foreign policy, when I describe the nation, the nature of America as a representative of freedom. And, it's really not. But what I hear from the left is they recognize the hypocrisy of America, but they don't recognize the hypocrisy of other states. All the other states are great and glorious and noble. Only America is the bad, evil guy. My friend Dimitri and I were in a conversation. I said, you know, the problem that people don't realize, it's always the state. And America looks, maybe America looks more evil than most of the other nations in the world right now. And I actually believe that's true. But the reason that they do is because they're the most powerful. They have the means to do the most stuff, and they have the most to lose by not doing evil stuff to hold on to their power. You take any other state in the world, and you put it in the position that America's in, and it'll act pretty much the same way as America will. It's a state problem. It's not an America problem.
Yeah, yeah. And it's definitely not just a Republican problem. And a lot of people, right. You know, the Republicans are so easy to point out and make fun of and say, you know, their attitudes are what's wrong with the world. You know, and a lot of leftists don't see it. They also don't see it with like, and this is going to tread on some really tricky
trigger warning. Hold on.
Yeah. Trigger warning. I'm really amazed that so many leftists in America are so into like coddling Muslims. And I've got friends that are Muslims, and you know, I got to say they're part of the good ones, but you know, Dobby and Will, but Muslims, I don't really know the statistics, but I would guess that somewhere between 15% and 60% of Muslims worldwide are more homophobic than like most Christian Republicans.
Yeah. Now, what do you describe as homophobic?
Homophobic? Well, thinking that, I mean, I don't think there's something wrong with somebody if they're disgusted by homosexuality. You know, that's them. But if they want to stop it, that's what I consider homophobia.
Okay, because I am a Christian, as you probably know from my Facebook page. And I most assuredly, I believe homosexuality is a sin. But I don't go around pointing at people and telling them that they're in sin. They don't believe in my Bible. They don't believe in my God. And I certainly am not in any way, shape, or form interested in using the state for an enforcement of my beliefs. That's why, you know, at the beginning I joked about the state-sanctioned sex.
And the squirrels, yeah. But,
right, exactly.
And I do not think that homosexuality is a sin, but I think it's a sin for people to think it should be a crime to think homosexuality is a sin. Now that's kind of a complicated triple negative. Let me explain that.
No, I get it, but you get it, but I'll explain.
I know. I'm talking to the audience. I know you get it. I think it's
claim for the peanut crunching crowd.
For the squirrels in the cheap seats. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if the word's sin, but I would say, I think it's a crime that the government has made it to where you can put someone out of business for not making a cake for a gay wedding. And I would also say anybody who's like making people who don't want to make cakes for gay people, you know, like going in specifically to people they know don't want to make their cake and making them make their cake, you're really effing stupid if you want your food prepared by someone who hates you. I've worked in restaurants. You know what happens in restaurants when people treat the wait staff or the cooks badly?
I've worked in restaurants. I've experienced.
They pee in your food, man. They throw flies in your food.
I never did that.
I never did it either, but I've seen it. I've seen it over and over and over.
Because I was a young man and did those kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But When it comes to, I mean, all of that stems from the 1964, the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
Which somebody should have stood up and said, dude, I mean, Now, you and I understand that the Constitution is a magic parchment, but just for being a devil's advocate, if you actually believe in this Constitution, that it has this magical power to protect our rights, you just created legislation that was a fundamental violation of the First Amendment.
That was
the
Kennedy, right?
Association. No, it was Johnson.
Johnson was a racist piece of crap, too.
He was a tool.
He was a warmongering. He probably killed Kennedy, too.
Maybe. I don't know. I believe anything. I believe it. If you walked up to me today and said that 911 was an inside job, I'd be like, why not?
I do not believe 911 was an inside job. I believe it was the direct result.
Saying I do.
Let me clarify mine, though. I do believe it was direct response to U.S. overseas intervention. U.S. and U.K. and Israel, intervention for the last 100 years, going back to Lawrence of Arabia. But I do believe Kennedy was a conspiracy. I don't know who it was, but it just seems too weird to be one guy with a rifle. Although, there is the theory, too. Boston Tea Party has a theory that it probably – well – I don't want to paraphrase him, but he says that that it's too horrifying for most Americans to believe the possibility that it was one guy with a rifle, because that gives one guy with a rifle too much power.
I seriously doubt that it was one guy.
I think it was the military industrial complex, because Kennedy was, he was a leftist, inveterate liberal, but he got some things right. Most of the good ones do, stop clock and such. But he was weird, because he was a leftist, but he was fiercely anti-communist, and he wanted to strip down the military-industrial complex. And I think there's just too much money,
I think with Kennedy, you have maybe one of the last of the old guard. Liberals and went out.
They also say he was the last legitimately elected president, which, who knows, but I've heard that. I don't know
if you could call anybody a legitimately elected president.
Yeah.
But he was the last of the, I'm not going to say classical liberal, because you and I are closer to what a classical liberal was than Kennedy. And I've actually gone way beyond what a classical liberal, because I've moved out of minarchist.
Well, I think he's the last of what we think of, you and I think of, who came from the left. And like when we were kids, we're like, oh, the Republicans are mean and liberals are kind. And really, that's an illusion of back to when America was good. That's as ridiculous as the right trying to get back to Leave It to Beaver or the day after.
Go back to the good old days in the 50s. Those the good old days.
Well, when Republicans, if
you're the right race and the right place.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Saying? Yeah. But, Kennedy was part of the elite. He was a big money. He was put into office because his brother was supposed to be in office. His brother got killed, and his dad said, well, I still got this one. That was like the year that the Democratic Party was shifting from being the KKK to being what it is now.
It started in the late 50s, right?
Of course, yeah, it started in the late 50s, but it really started... it was a Democratic convention in like 62 or 63 where, enough people had gone down to the South and signed up enough blacks to vote and died doing it to where they had the numbers. It was very similar to what happened with Ron Paul at the GOP convention a few years ago. Like, literally, they worked their butts off to work within the system. They got enough names on the signatures on the ballots and people in the room and voters to be a part of the political process, and the Democrats in the 60s and the Republicans with Ron Paul changed the rules on the floor and said, no, we're not going to give you a swing at the bat. And what that led to with the Democrats was the Black Panthers and the we tried to work within the system, we're going to carry shotguns now instead, kill Whitey, kill the pigs. And what it led to with Ron Paul was basically all the smart minarchists becoming anarcho-capitalists and voluntarists.
Well, the Black Panthers of the 60s was
different.
Tame in comparison to.
Well, it was a different organization than now. It was. The one then was concerned with self-defense and education you know, creating their own system outside the mainstream system. And the one now is probably mostly FBI agents. It is just a bunch of racists who want to bait white people.
So you think they gathered a bunch of black supremacists and a couple FBI operatives to make sure to rouse them up in the right way?
I think they started as an angry Black Lives Matter with guns kind of thing, or with, you know, weapons, with nunchucks. And I think they did what they always do, which is bust a few of them and then say, you know, you're going to work for us now. Anytime you're that extreme, you're, you know, and like, walking down the street is a felony, you know, because of what you're doing, they're going to bust somebody in your group and infiltrate you. And I really recommend everyone read that book, Rats, by Claire Wolf. You can get it from rats-nosnitch.com for free, or it's actually included and embedded in the Fiends Android app. That's why that Android app is 7 megs.
I didn't see that.
In the latest version of it.
Explore the app more.
Get the latest version.
I just realized that you have the Amazon. And by the way, if you have the Freedom Fiends app, be sure that you click on the Amazon link when you're going to buy something from Amazon.
So let's wrap it up here quick so I don't lose my voice. Yeah. But let's talk about BIPCOT for a minute.
Okay, let's end this glorious, fantastic interview that you got to participate in. You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
With a little BIPCOT.
You're welcome.
Yeah, BIPCOT is a quasi open source license I created, and the reason I say quasi open source is the Open Source Initiative, who are kind of the official by default regulatory body of determining what can be called open source, told me it's not an open source license. I tagged it as open source when we first started doing this a year ago, the BIPCOT license, from BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. It stands for Beastlick Internet Policy Commission Outreach Team, which is the ridiculous name for the software company Derek Slopey and I started. And
which I just call it BIPCOT.
Oh, did I say BIPCOT? No, the B stands for Beastlick. Beastlick is what I live in Casper, Wyoming, but I joke that I live in Beastlick, Wyoming, which is kind of, you know, my version of bumfuck Utah, bumfuck Egypt. Right. You know, Beastlick is any town in Wyoming that's not Casper, Cheyenne, or Gillette, you know.
We have some Beastlicks out in Pennsylvania. I'm talking to you from Pennsylvania, by the way.
I lived in Pennsylvania for 4 years. I lived in Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Weren't you in a student home?
I was in a reform school. I was in a school called the Church Farm School.
I went to one too. So we have that. I went to Scotland School of Veterans Children.
Oh, Scotland School of Veteran Children.
Scotland School for Veterans Children. It was supposedly for orphans, but I was not an orphan.
That's kind of interesting because the Church Farm School, you had to be either from a broken home or the son of clergy or the son of a military vet.
And you were son of clergy, right?
No, I was from a broken home.
I was just kidding, but
no. I wanted to go into the clergy. Steve Miller was trying to go into the clergy and then change his mind. Why he quit was because he realized that, first of all, he's gay, and they don't like that very much in the clergy generally. But he basically realized...
There are.
And he was Lutheran, I think, which allows more levity.
You're going to become an Episcopalian.
Yeah, I know. The Church Farm School is an Episcopal school, which I call that Catholicism light. It's Catholicism with half the guilt.
I'm going to say something mean here. It's a trigger warning. Episcopalians, for people who, we like God, but just not that much. Sorry.
I say it's like Catholicism light. Catholicism with half the guilt, which is funny because I said that like 30 years ago. And then Marilyn Manson said the same thing in his autobiography. Whereas I do think he borrowed from our version of Personal Jesus, I do not think he ever heard that I said, I think he just came up with it independently because he also was raised Episcopal. And it's just kind of like great minds think alike, you know? Yeah, it's like Catholicism with half the guilt. So BIPCOT is, here's the thing. Like I really, when I went from leftist statist to minarchist to anarcho-capitalist. The one thing that was my stickler, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I think the government's bad, but what about the roads? Like, I immediately gave up the roads. I was like, the roads are already built, and, you know, who would maintain them? Road builders, you know. If there's ways that can all be done without a government, all of that. But the one thing I clung to was, longer than anything, was intellectual property. And the reason I clung to it was because I make my living at it, too. It's, you know, when I was going through this transition, I was, you know, having a successful living writing 500-page books. You know, I wasn't publishing them, self-publishing them on Amazon. I was being paid advances and royalties to write them.
You were a professional.
Yeah, I was a professional. And I also was doing the same thing with DVDs of movies I was making. And, I mean, I was doing deals of, like, you know, licensing the rights to a movie I made to, like, a company in England for England-only rights for $20,000. Like, stuff like that that you couldn't really do without IP. And I was doing it in book writing and filmmaking, and I had done it before in music. You know, I made about $80,000 in my career in BOM, which, you know, over 10 years' time isn't much, but it's more than most people make playing 10 years in a garage band.
I write music too, and I made $500 off my music.
Cool.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
So I'm a professional, right?
Yeah. I recently made $500 licensing 8 seconds of a movie that I made 12 years ago to Dave Grohl. That was pretty cool. He did that, you know, that whole, what was it called, Sonic Highways series about recording studios, but also, like, the scene in certain cities. The Chicago one has 8 seconds of video from the DVD extras of my movie DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist, of Steve Albini, because he's in the movie and they interviewed him in it, but they just wanted this, like, 8 seconds that was on my thing. So, you know,
I've seen some of that Star or Die stuff. It's like on YouTube, it's like in all these different parts, and I haven't gotten through all the parts.
Which one? The DIY thing?
Yeah.
It's also really low res because, like, I uploaded it like 9 years ago, and internet connection and, like, computers weren't good enough
and
to
the
even
sound. The sound is no, I'm just kidding.
It sounds as good as it can be, considering it was shot on 10 different cameras in four different cities. But
so for you, Bipcot. IP, my biggest thing was rule of law. I couldn't let go of law. And actually,
Wolf, the animal?
Rule of law.
Oh, I just said wolf law. Wolf law. I was like, I think we got to protect the wolves.
I'm talking to a crazy man.
No, okay.
Yeah. So, and it was actually Lou. That he was the guy that
pushed you into the chasm.
He cracked the door open because he was like, "Well, show me where." Basically, because I was always
show me how it's working now.
Foundations and truth, right? Well, no. What he said, he said, "What is the foundation of truth for rule of law?" Because this was always my thing. And rule of law was like, "Listen, man, rule of law is the foundation of truth that we need to govern one another in a peaceable way." And then as I went through the process. I let it go. And once I let that go, then it was fine. But then I did get to the IP thing. I'd already crossed over, but I did get to the IP thing, and it still is a problem for me. I mean, I've let it go, but it is still, it's something that I've
it's not a problem for me, and here's what worked for me was realizing it doesn't matter anymore because of file sharing. Like, even if you can cling to, well, I think people should have to pay me to download my movie, when anybody in the world with a computer can publish your movie to the rest of the world now anonymously, copyright really doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I make my living writing articles, and it's difficult letting that go. And actually, I'm still in a bit of a bind because I started a company with three other people, and the stuff that I do for that company, for instance, I can't put Bipcot.org on it.
I know, but writing articles for money can still work without IP. You know, I mean.
Oh, no, right. But see, I like, okay, I run a newspaper. We're all equal partners of it, but I'm pretty much the one running it right now. And I would love to put bipcot.org on that newspaper, but I can't because it's not all mine.
Well, the same thing with me. Like, you know, if I haven't done any paid writing work for the same industry I used to work in for a few years, partially, and here's my theory, and I think this is true. All those people are inveterate leftists, and when they heard I became a gun guy, they quit hiring me for stuff. Oh, no. You know.
Yeah, and I have watched your gun training
with the non-aggression principle. Yeah, yeah, and those,
I highly recommend it.
Yeah, like all of the the four different publishers I worked for, like all followed me on Twitter, and when I started posting stuff that scared them, they quit thinking of me as a go-to guy to hire for stuff. Like, I didn't just write books. I also, like, edited other people's books and did, you know, like, tech proofing of other people's books and did, like, piecemeal work for them here and there. They paid really well, you know? I mean, it would be, like, $6,000 for a month of full-time work, and I got a lot of stuff like that and, like, sometimes didn't even get my name on it, which it didn't matter because it was, like, just proofreading, really. Proofreading and tightening things up and checking all the tech tutorials, but they just stopped like 4 or 5 years ago for the most part, and then like totally like 2 years ago just stopped calling me for that kind of stuff. But you know, if one of those companies called me tomorrow and said, you know, we want you to write a chapter in a book and it's going to be copyrighted, I'd be fine with it. Pay me and you can put your copyright on it. Hubert Selby Jr. said it really well when I interviewed him. You know, if you check out the Hubert Selby It'll Be Better Tomorrow, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow documentary I made, the one that's narrated by Robert Downey Jr. That DVD's out there. It's actually on the torrents. I put it on the torrents myself after it'd been out for a few years. I bootleg most of my own stuff, except stuff that other people own the copyright on. So, because I'm respectful of that, because that's their thing. Hubert Selby
put it. Understand my position.
Yeah, and yeah, Hubert Selby is, you know, I mean, he's a heavy cat, and he's somebody who's very respectable in literary circles, and he's dead now, and I shot the last interview he did right before he died and then made this documentary with, you know, help from his estate, basically, with the blessings of his estate. And you know, he's not a lightweight. He's someone that, like, writers aspire to be like. And he's had, you know, he's done better than most authors have ever done. He's had two huge mainstream Hollywood movies made of his books, Last Exit to Brooklyn and Requiem for a Dream, that are not only like big movies that were successful, they're really well done. Like, you know, those are movies that filmmakers study, especially Requiem for a Dream.
I love Last Exit to Brooklyn. That's a really great.
Not many people have seen that movie. It's really well done, and it's got a really weird, cool cast too. Like, it's got Jerry Orbach from Law and Order, and it's
very
got
disturbing.
It's got
disturbing movie.
You know, it's got the Baldwin brother that's now a right wing nut job playing a gay hustler. You know, I mean, it's a really weird movie, but and I interviewed the filmmaker of it too in that movie. But in the DVD extras of that movie, which you should check out if you want to, it's an hour of audio only. That like didn't make it. It's actually just the whole interview I did with him. He says this thing that's great. He quotes Hemingway. You know, I said, like, how do you feel about, you know, how do you like mix making art and being an artist with like the idea of people thinking you sell out if you make a living and stuff? And he says, well, he before he quoted Hemingway, he said, or I quoted Hemingway, forget the Hemingway thing. What he said, and this was his words, was he said, when you sell a book, it's like selling a pound of butter. You know, it's not treated like, and I'm paraphrasing now after that, like, it's not treated, basically the people that buy your stuff don't care about art. They care about money. And what I would say is that really that's the people you want selling your art. If they don't muck with it too much. Like, the corporate, you know, I used to be, when I was a leftist punk rocker, I was, like, kind of anti-corporation, and then got signed to Warner Brothers, which we got a lot of crap for. And, like, there was a company called StickerGuy.com. He still makes stickers. Like, this is before he was .com. It was just Sticker Guy in Vegas. He used to make all the stickers.
He hadn't gotten the .com yet.
Right. There wasn't a .com yet. This was in the 80s. As soon as we got signed to Warner Brothers, he wouldn't do orders for us anymore. You know? Like he just, he would, because we'd sold out. Yeah. Yeah. And we were still starving on Warner Brothers. We're still like touring in a van and sleeping on floors, but you know, he thought we'd sold out, so he wouldn't do our buttons anymore. But you know what, really what I found is like the corporations pay you when they say they're going to pay you. And the record companies, the small record companies that exist out of a love for music tend to go out of business owing you money, you know?
You know, it's interesting. We do, in our company, we do web marketing, SEO, that kind of stuff. And our best clients, by far and away, are businesses.
Just yeah.
Flat, straight out businesses. When we deal with causal groups, whether they're Christian or whatever, I mean, we have thousands of dollars owed to us, and that money that's owed to us is all by these type of organizations.
People that want to change the world.
Right, exactly. So
yeah.
So why don't we wrap this interview up? And I am Paul Gordon Collier with Disassociation Nation, and Niz is hopefully, he will be back soon after fighting off his drone attacks. And Michael, I've been talking to Michael Dean, the co-founder of Freedom Fiends, the former lead singer of Bomb, as well as a filmmaker, and you do a bunch of other stuff as well.
Bibcot.org.
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 Bibcot, everything
in it's your spreading, life. And it's kind of, it's surprising me.
How, it is. I am, you know, seeing, because I was there in the beginning. I'm proud to say I was there in the beginning.
I'll say this too.
I am seeing it pick up.
I'll end with this. There's a saying that I came up with like 15 years ago that I still stand by. And it's why Bibcot was good enough to take off. And like, there's other things I've done that you've never heard of that were done as well as Bibcot. But my saying is, do everything as if it's the only thing you'll ever be remembered for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I do want to thank you very much for coming on our show. It was really an honor and a privilege to have you on your show. And I want to thank you for the Freedom Fiends, because truly, the Freedom Fiends is my morning breakfast. And I'll say this in passing. If you haven't listened to the Freedom Fiends, you need to listen to it. There's a lot of shows out there that, especially for us ANCAP type folks, you start listening to them in the beginning and you're like, okay, I kind of outgrew that. Freedom Fiends, what I love about the Freedom Fiends is if you know nothing about ANCAP, if you know nothing about True Liberty, this is a show for you to listen to. But if you're a seasoned veteran in Liberty, this is a show for you to listen to. There are not many shows like that. And for me, Freedom Fiends is reality TV on radio for ANCAPers.
Steve Miller-Miller said it's, I like that. Steve Miller-Miller said it's the view for people leaving the bar in the middle of the night, like when the bar closes.
Yeah, I think of it as I think of it as Jersey Shore with a little bit more class.
Oh man,
for ANCAPers. So there you go.
No, I think it's more
it's class.
It's more the real world. Class. It's more the real world than Jersey Shore.
Yes, exactly. It's more the real world, because like, I listen to the show a lot of times. I want to find out, okay, what's going on with the Kissing Fiends, Lou and Lisa. Yeah. I want to know.
Well, I think there's another pair happening, but
there's something else budding out there, which is, we won't talk about. Yeah. But I'm very excited
ferrets
about the
second
budding that we're.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So thank you very much, Michael, for being on this show. And we got to have you back on in a live setting as well.
All right. Cool, man.
And we're out.
Worms.